Covert Action.
Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Chris Garaffa.
And I'm Rachel Hu. Big data and surveillance tech firm Palantir is working with the U.S. government to bring its software into multiple government agencies under the Trump administration. In April, Wired reported that the company had a $30 million contract with ICE to provide, quote, near real-time visibility on immigrants in the country. Late in May, the New York Times revealed that the company is expanding its government work across agencies, including the Social Security Administration, Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and more, in the $113 million in new contracts, on top of the already existing $795 million that they were just awarded by the Pentagon. CI Connected Palantir counts the agency's investment firm and Kitel as an early backer, and was founded in 2003 by hardcore conservative libertarian Peter Thiel, along with CEO Alex Karp and two others. Its work with the U.S. government, as well as allies in Ukraine, Israel, Australia, and many private companies. Its growth as a private partner in the extension of U.S. government surveillance and data collection in the age of AI should absolutely be a cause of concern of all people, no matter which party is in the White House. There really is so much to get into this, Chris. I know you are our security surveillance tech expert, and I really want to pick your brain on some of this. But when I saw this article, it really blew my mind in so many ways, because it's just like, you know, I didn't even think about the Social Security Administration. I didn't think about these other ways in which we can think about upping surveillance. Like, it's not that I didn't think we didn't have mass surveillance, but the fact that there are so many departments that they could be moving into is absolutely a serious cause for concern. But I love kind of your diagnosis on this.
It's super interesting to me looking at where they're going into. So not just where you'd think there'd be mass surveillance and data analysis, but also places like the IRS. You know, the IRS has, of course, a lot of data. They know about every single paycheck we get. They know about, obviously, our tax returns. We all have to put a lot of information on those returns. Do we own a house? Do all of those things. What really comes from that is what they're going to be doing is actually looking through and like analyzing the data better. So for taxes, it could be like who's sending money to certain charities. Are we seeing clusters? Are we seeing, you know, all of these things? But I want to actually step back and talk about what a Palantir is. I get to nerd out for a little bit here. If people remember the Lord of the Rings, the Palantirs are those like crystal balls.
No way.
And y'all on the radio can't see Rachel shaking her head at me right now, but the Palantir is the crystal ball. That is, the Palantir is the word that J.R.R. Tolkien actually came up with for these things. They're the crystal balls that you can see, you can use to either look into the past or look at something that is far
away. Well, that's terrifying.
Now, what's super, super interesting here, too, is that if you remember your Tolkien lore, the Palantirs were not always accurate. They were in some ways not... They were not consistent or reliable narrators, even if you were looking at something that was, you know, happening in the past, because they kind of gave you one perspective. In the Silmarillion, J.R.R. Tolkien says that those using the stones had to possess great strength of will and mind in order to get the most benefit from using them. And so I think what is being said here by naming the company Palantir after these mythical things from the Tolkien universe is that, you know, not only is it that they are all, you know, they're able to see all of these things, but that the people that develop, sell, and use the technology are then able to be of great strength of will and mind in order to, you know, be, when they're using these products that Palantir sells. So I think we have to understand a lot of history here. We have to understand a lot of subtext and context when we're talking about Palantir itself as a company. So what is Palantir? I mean, the company started just after 9/11, started in 2003. It was founded by Alex Karp, Peter Thiel, who is probably the most infamous of the founders of Palantir, and two other people, Stephen Cohen and Joe Lonsdale. So these four guys founded the company in 2003. Remember, this is just after 9/11. There had already been calls for a mass national information sharing database by people like Larry Ellison of Oracle. Oracle, another CIA company, you mentioned it in the intro, InQtel is this CIA investment firm. They are the venture capital firm of the CIA. They are what gave Palantir part of its start, along with Peter Thiel's massive wealth that he got from helping to co-found PayPal. And I think we're going to come back to some of that connection because it really ties into what's been going on in the government otherwise today. Alex Karp is certainly a wealthy person, too. He's actually a very interesting story with Alex Karp. He does not know how to drive. He says that when he was poor, he didn't have the money to get a car and learn how to drive. And then all of a sudden, he was very wealthy and doesn't need to drive, suggesting that because other people do the driving for him. The Alex Karp is maybe the second most well-known person around Palantir. Of course, Peter Thiel, and we've talked about Thiel in the past a lot. But, Alex Karp is actually, I think they have very different politics, those two. Really different politics, in fact. Alex Karp called himself a socialist and then said he voted for Hillary Clinton in a 2018 interview. Now, of course, you're not, you could say you're a socialist and have voted for Clinton, whatever. But like, if you're running this giant type of data analytics and spying firm, you are clearly not a socialist. I mean, that's just like flat out there. But it actually, and I want to get into this later, Rachel, and talk about this, like it really exposes how Karp thinks about these public-private partnerships and, Western superiority in his
definitely
mind.
Definitely. I've been thinking a lot about this, Chris, because the Trump administration and kind of the ruling class that aligns themselves with Trump, in a lot of ways, the way that they're approaching the government is in a like rob or baron mindset. Like, what can we take from it? What can we gut before things go south? I mean, everything about it feels that way to me. And it seems like with these contracts, it's the same vein of like, how can these individual companies make as much money as possible and completely disregard civil liberties, disregard laws, disregard all the potential that backlash that could come with this? I mean, the fact is to me, Chris, that the United States before Trump, well before Trump, I would honestly believe, like in terms of privacy laws, we've stopped legislating for the last 10 years. I mean, at least 10 years. I don't know the last time there was a major, major kind of protection passed for everyday people's data. Maybe on the state levels for sure, but I'm talking national, federal legislation. I haven't personally seen it. Maybe you're more aware than I am. But it really does speak volumes to me that we haven't had this kind of major breakthrough in protecting people's civil liberties and people's data and privacy, because it opens the door for things like this. Like, what exactly is the government going to do with this data? I mean, there's a lot they can do with AI algorithms. I mean, in some ways, it terrifies me, because what if they sell it to private insurance companies? That's always what I think about. Like, if you're talking about these combination of data from all these different agencies, you could sell all of that to private, credit card companies and say, well, this person is, this is their wage, this is what they're making, like they're your real information, so much so that they could make a profile on you and decide to deny you the ability to get a line of credit. So there's just a lot, like in terms of that private, like to what you're speaking to, the private public partnership, and how the lines here are dissolved. They're not even blurred. They're completely dissolved. I mean, I feel like Elon Musk especially has also, with his time in the Trump administration, just evaporated the lines between private and public. And this feels like another one of those steps that might be flying a little more under the radar, just because people aren't super in the know about the surveillance technology that the U.S. has access to, but should certainly be paying attention to. But I don't know if you're aware of other legislation, Chris, but that's kind of my immediate thought is like, where are all of the basic protections? Because having access to this kind of data, it seems like maybe it's innocuous at first, or it's not a big deal at first. But when you really start thinking about it, it's just all encompassing, like your student loan provider. I mean, everything. Like, wow, it could really change the game for us.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about all of the different legislation, there have been some good state level legislation. Yeah. I think the California has really good legislation, if you, whenever you're on a website, you might see at the bottom, like, I live in California, don't sell my information. But like, they usually reject your claim if you don't live in California, which is like ridiculous. Just like, do it for everyone. But that's, you know, that's one thing on the state level. You know, there have been things on the federal level. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, before Donald Trump gutted it, was doing some interesting things to protect data from, you know, these resellers, from these, you know, data firms and all of that. But they weren't, nothing has touched the U.S. government's surveillance programs. In fact, the FISA is still out there, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which we've talked about a number of times. You know, there's a number of provisions in this. Of course, the biggest one that we know of, or that we're mostly concerned about, is Section 702, which is the warrantless wiretapping program that the NSA and others use to just spy on and surveil all of our communications, whether they're listening to a specific, you know, the recording of a call or just getting the metadata. You know, they, and remember they've said, you know, we kill people based on metadata. I think that was Nakasone, maybe it was a different NSA guy. In any case, Section 702 of FISA has been renewed every 2 years. It actually is up for renewal in 2026, and I'm very curious to see what happens with this, because Donald Trump in 2024 said Congress should kill FISA. Now, he said this not because he cares about the, you know, surveillance of average Americans or people anywhere in the world, but because he claims the FBI, you know, spied on his campaign in 2016. That's why he says the kill FISA. But like many things that we have seen, I think what Donald Trump says and what Donald Trump does are two very different things. I do not expect him to call in 2026 for FISA or even just Section 702 to be renewed. But this gets back to a key question about, so yes, there's the spying stuff, right? There's the NSA spying on all of our communications and the CIA and the FBI. The DEA even involved in this. One of the earliest programs that I remember learning about, certainly not one of the earliest programs, but a predecessor really to the NSA's, you know, mass spying program, was the DEA in the early 90s. They were tracking telephone information. They were tracking who you're making phone calls to. If they weren't listening to the calls, they were tracking who the calls were to, when they were happening, what were patterns they were seeing in the conversations and all of that. And that was the early 90s. I mean, technology has advanced so much right now. So, of course, we have, you know, we know about all of the, you know, PRISM and everything that Edward Snowden, you know, exposed and told us about, and everything that has, you know, certainly there are other programs that have come since. And Palantir is working with all of these things. So not just the fact that when you put in a student loan application to the federal government, you're applying, you know, and you're sending information. And when you do your taxes, you're supplying information to the federal government. You're on Medicare. You have to submit your reimbursements, you know, things like that. The things that day to day we all have to do, and the realities of just living in the world, you know, like the information that we have to share with one agency or another, is a completely, I think, separate question in many ways than the NSA, you know, spying on all of our keystrokes kind of question. But Palantir is involved with both. So like I was saying earlier, if the government can look at IRS data more quickly, if they can process it, if they can see patterns that they're looking for, the question then becomes, well, who are they going to be looking for? Are they going to be looking for people who are donating to Palestinian causes? Are they going to be looking for people who are donating to civil rights organizations, civil liberties organizations, who are against exactly this kind of thing? If you send money to the ACLU, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Free Software Foundation, Government Accountability Project, you know, any of these, are they going to start, you know, using that profile information that they do collect just based on the fact that you're probably listing those as tax deductible donations on your taxes, right? You're claiming them. You know, what are they going to do with that? Are they going to start coming after people based on what presidential campaign they donated to? Because you have to report, you know, when you make a donation to a political campaign, you, if you're like a average person and not a multimillionaire who can just give to a PAC, you're an average person, you have to say who you are, what your employee, you know, who your employer is, what your job is, all of that stuff. And that's public information. So it's not even to me about the collection of the information. It's that they want to use Palantir to sort through and surface trends within this information even more. Palantir, there's a third factor, I think, of what Palantir does too. And that is looking at the way it works with the military. So Alex Karp, in his book, he's got this entire sections based on touting like how much great stuff Palantir does for the military and how it made them more effective on the battlefield. That's the kind of scary stuff that we should be thinking about. And certainly Palantir, not the only company that does this. Remember, it was a few years ago when Microsoft said that they wanted to provide ultimate lethality, I think was a similar, a close approximation of what this Microsoft CEO said. They wanted to provide, you know, with their HoloLens product, that those glasses, the goggles you put in your face, they wanted to provide like, you know, a high lethality services to the Pentagon. So looking at, you know, the kind of stuff that Palantir provides to the U.S. military and to its intelligence services, they say, you know, they're connecting all of the spy agencies. They're using it, they say, to predict the location of improvised of IEDs, those, you know, roadside bombs, improvised explosive devices in Afghanistan, I believe also in Iraq. I mean, that technology could be used for good, but it was actually just being used so that the Marines Marines and the Army in Afghanistan could go from city to city and kill people and knock down doors. I mean, really, really awful uses of that technology.
Definitely. You know, as you're talking, Chris, I'm thinking about all the ways in which this data could be used. I mean, I was just thinking about how I know for years the FBI has wanted to kind of profile who could become a radical. Like this idea, I mean, this is something that they've worked on in the 60s, kind of came up with those kind of bits and pieces of things to watch out for like local law enforcement stuff. And I'm thinking about how they could use algorithmic data. Like, how can you use an AI to determine who in particular? It's almost like sci-fi stuff almost, but like who might have proclivities towards wanting to be involved in more progressive politics? Like, with all the data at people's disposal, like if you could really sort through all of this, you could really even have predictive models, which is what terrifies me. Like the idea of like predicting what people could do or where they could go. But I think that it's important that sometimes it feels like this stuff could be so far off in the future, but realistically it's here, it's happening. And in fact, the fact that Palantir has this contract with ICE is absolutely just concerning on every level, because that means that this company is tracking who is undocumented, who is not, and where they physically are located. And like, how are things like Snapchat or other kind of location, like, and not just Snapchat with like Snap apps, but like other apps that like you've given your location to, how is that data being used? Because if you're undocumented and you have an app on your phone that gives away your location data, do they have access to it? You know, I don't know the technological capabilities, but I would say that there's so many vulnerabilities with that. There's so many ways to track a person, their GPS location when it comes to a phone. And for people who have status at risk, I mean, that's a really, really big deal. So I was just kind of wondering your thoughts on this relationship between this type of surveillance, immigration, and the militarization of the border.
Oh, it's completely connected. You know, we know that, you know, Palantir and a number of other companies, they work with Israel just as much as they do with the United States. And in fact, when you look at some of these companies, especially the Israeli companies, they often come to the U.S. and they say, you know, hey, we've proven our technology in Israel, meaning we've proven it by attacking Palestinians with it, or using it to surveil Palestinians, or using it to, you know, do whatever, you know, it is that they're doing against Palestinians. Elbit Systems, I think, is one of the most infamous ones that did that. And then they went down to the U.S. border and installed a bunch of spy equipment for the U.S. government that actually ended up spying on a native reservation, which should be a sovereign land for the indigenous people who are, you know, within the state of Arizona. That should be sovereign land, but they were being spied on by, you know, by the U.S. government because they were close to the border. And so I think that, yeah, looking at the connection between surveillance, between immigration, you know, there was an app called CBP One that Customs and Border Protection had under the Obama administration that you could use. And, you know, if you went down to the border, you would see people, many people were even sharing phones to sign into this app, because this is how you would get your appointment for asylum. You know, it would tell you like, hey, you can get an appointment today, or, you know, things like that. And you would use it to check in. The Trump administration has since taken that app and just told it to just show people a message saying that they need to self-deport, and that they, if they don't self-deport, they will be caught and deported. Now, this app has access to your location. So it's not just that Palantir comes in and you know, I don't know if Palantir is working with data from this particular app, but I would assume that they are or will be based on these new contracts that they're getting. But they come in and they, if they have the information about who has said they're going to deport, and then, you know, let's say you got into the United States and you didn't take the app off your phone, well, it's still sending location information most likely back to the app's servers. Well, Palantir can get that and say, not just here's where this person is, or here's where they were a few minutes ago, an hour ago, a day ago, but here's where groups of people are. And then ICE can unleash the terror that we've already seen them unleashing at even more effective, I hate to even use that word, but efficient levels. That's some of the power that they're going to have here. And it gets to some of the scary things about Alex Karp and how Alex Karp looks at the use of technology. In his book, The Technological Republic, he actually calls Chapter 1 The Lost Valley. And he starts it out by saying, Silicon Valley has lost its way. He looks at the time, you know, the mid-1900s, in particular, the World War II period and the just, you know, slight post-war period, basically before Vietnam. And looks at he says, this was the American century, and engineers were at the heart of the era's ascendant mythology. The pursuit of public interest through science and engineering was considered a natural extension of the national project, which entailed not only protecting U.S. interests, but moving society and indeed civilization up the hill. And he goes on later to say, as Silicon Valley turned inward and toward the consumer, the U.S. government and the governments of many of its allies scaled back involvement and innovation across numerous domains, from space travel to military software to medical research. Throughout the book, you see this theme that he has, and he discusses Edward Said, he discusses Noam Chomsky, he discusses a number of others, where he says that, oh, it was the 1960s where society started kind of falling apart, and we need to, you know, rebuild Western culture, and we need to rebuild Western supremacy. In much of his book and in many of the interviews that he does, Alex Karp talks about how, you know, the world wouldn't exist without the West, how the West is clearly the superior culture, meaning, you know, Western capitalist, you know, white culture is clearly the superior culture. I mean, he is a raving racist, but he's not like the Ben Shapiro's or the Charlie Kirk's or the Laura Loomers that you see. He puts it in these pseudo-technical, pseudo-scientific terms. And like I said earlier, he actually called himself a socialist in the sense that he wants the government to do good things. But what are those good things? That's actually taking over the rest of the world. I mean, I think we should, any socialist would disavow his calling himself a socialist. But he goes into talking about how the society started to degrade in the 60s with the counterculture movement, which also certainly is talking about, it's talking about, yes, the Vietnam War movement, the movement against that war, but also talking about the civil rights movement. We can't forget that, right? The civil rights movement from the 50s into the 60s that really became a militant movement in the 60s is part of what he's actually talking about here. And he says that we should use technology, and on its face, this is not bad. We should use technology not to provide, you know, he doesn't say it with these words, not to provide the endless loop of, you know, dopamine feeding videos that we all rely on through, you know, TikTok and Instagram and all of that, but actually to make the world a better place. Now, that sounds like a good idea, but again, what is he talking about? He is talking about making the world in terms of the Western world a better place. And by doing so, returning the private-public partnerships to where they were, returning the scientists to the glory that he says that they once had. He's talking about people like Oppenheimer and Einstein, and others on the Manhattan Project, for example. And of course, I mean, people saw Oppenheimer, and we talked about this on an episode when the movie came out. You know, we know that these scientists were at the very least extremely conflicted once they had seen what the bomb could do. But he puts out this idea that engineering should be going to benefiting Western society, benefiting the West, benefiting capitalism through the state. It's a semi-fascist, really, ideal. So something that we all have to actually be very aware of and be very cautious of as we approach the kind of ideas. And as we said in the beginning, Rachel, you know, this is not, Palantir didn't come out of nowhere. And its government contracts didn't just start last year. It got government contracts in 2013. It got them in 2014, 2015. What I'm saying is, under both the Bush and Obama administrations, as well as Trump 1 and Biden, Palantir was getting its contracts with various elements of the U.S. government, particularly intelligence agencies and the Pentagon. And that's why I'm saying that no matter who is in office, we have to actually be really concerned about Palantir getting more and more entrenched in this spy and data system, because no matter who's in office, either of these, both of these parties have worked with Palantir. We see the distinctions between, you know, a Peter Thiel and an Alex Karp, who are both making significant money here. One voted and supported Trump, one voted for Clinton. They don't care as long as they're making money and living out their visions, which it's very clear to me that even if their political visions differ slightly, their ultimate vision for the way the U.S. should be the global hegemon is much the same.
Definitely. You know, I kind of want to call back to one of the episodes that we did a little while back about kind of the technological fascism, and how fascism has always had this kind of interesting futuristic bent. And I think that what you're describing, all the things you're sharing, really does, it's very smart on the right's behalf, especially to call back to science and Einstein and all of these people who did have, like, well, one, they were pretty progressive when you talk about Einstein, but that's like a separate conversation in and of itself. But to call back to science in a kind of evangelical growing right, where people are anti-science. I mean, this is clearly a separate faction of the right, which, like the left, has many different ideas. In fact, I would say almost sometimes more so, the right is in a very, very divided state, just because the right is currently in power through Trump and through Vought and the kind of Heritage Foundation and all that Project 2025 represents. There's still quite a large gradation on the right of all the different politics represented. And I think that this is kind of one of those trends that's really worth paying attention to, because just because you hail science or value science doesn't mean that you can't then twist that right into what you're saying, Chris, which is this kind of racist, you know, Western, ultimately fascistic agenda, because that's what this is. I mean, I think it is pretty bare that, you know, the Nazis played on this as well, not to always go nuclear to the Nazis, but I think it is actually important to bring in to the conversation how much this kind of desire for technological advancement or techno-fascism, like what exactly that ends up looking like. So we did a whole episode on this. I think it's worth kind of diving into. Highly recommend people listen to it. And in general, I think it's really important for people to be able to pick out the right wing, even when it is somehow able to incorporate Chomsky or others that's still politically to the right, you know, however it might be. So
I think you're absolutely right, Rachel, because I think, like, when we look at the way Karp has written this book, yeah, talking about Said and talking about Chomsky and others, right? But he's trying to appeal to this ethos that you do find in a lot of engineers, right? You do find this in a lot of people who value science and truth over all else, where, you know, we shouldn't have to, you know, debate. He actually has an interesting quote towards the end of the book where he says, We have begun to privilege the symbolism of victory, the more theatrical elements and outward displays that constitute expression of our own moral superiority over actual and often less than visible advances and improvements in the standards of living and quality of life. And what he's talking about here, he goes on to say, the risk is that we abandon a moral or ethical system oriented around results, the outcomes that matter most to people, less hunger, crime, disease, and matter of a far more performative discourse where the management of messages around such outcomes eclipses the importance of the outcomes themselves. So going back to the conversation that we had, Rachel, this sounds like that effective accelerationism idea, which he is not. I don't think he is one of those, but it sounds like that idea where it's like, hey, you know, forget the things that are going to happen now. Like, there might be bad things that happen now, but, you know, the outcome is what we're looking for. We don't need to question security. We don't need to question privacy. We don't need to question all those things. The outcome that we're looking for is actually the most important thing here. And he's basically saying that he's against woke in philosophical language. I mean, that's, you know, like if he were on Twitter, he'd be like, I hate woke. But he is writing a book here, and so he's saying, you know, differently. I think that, you know, it's really a way to actually just completely ignore the questions that arise with any technological development. Because earlier in the chapter, that same chapter, he's talking about the development of like surveillance technologies for police, right? So that's the context in which he's actually saying this. He's really dismissing that, you know, that there should be conversation by those who are going to be impacted by new technologies, and that, you know, their fears and concerns and ideas should be taken into consideration. But anyway, Rachel, go get back into it.
Yeah, so much here. I mean, I wanted to reflect a little bit on this kind of techno-fascism and actually move a little bit to Peter Thiel, because I think it's really important that we kind of see all of this all together and kind of the political trends that are this is flowing out of. I mean, this techno-fascist ideas, what it really is like, you know, if you kind of break it all down of where they're going, is the idea is that AI is going to completely destroy, displace, and dismantle the working class as a class. I mean, that's the desire, the ultimate goal of a lot of this. I mean, technocratic thinking that really is a part of our conversation today is the conversation of the dream of automation, which I think is a big part of what drives a lot of these kind of capitalists in this moment. They're looking to automate out. But it's also that's their vision of the future. I mean, there's a socialist vision of the future where we have automation that alleviates man's burden of having to work. But, you know, that's one where we have all of our needs met. In a fascist technocratic future, it's that the working class becomes abolished as an entire class. And technology allows this kind of fantasy of a fully bourgeois society to be able to function, no longer having to deal with the tension of class, the tension of the people that you exploit. So that's in a lot of ways kind of the technocratic vision that drives so many of these capitalists. And I think that like there's this really big scam of like these greater than life capitalist innovators that I think has really been pushed in these narratives. I mean, Peter Thiel being one of them, which I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on his whole like PayPal mafia thing. Like it's just kind of crazy. And I also think it's really kind of interesting to me about how he's been moving behind the scenes all of this time. I mean, Thiel has been this driving force behind so many of the trends in the tech industry for decades. So it's not just PayPal. It's about all of the ways in which, you know, he brought other things in. Thiel created several other companies outside of Palantir, which I think are worth talking about. Obviously, PayPal, but also Confinity, which was founded by Thiel, that also merged with X.com. This was the online bank that Elon Musk founded. This was like in the late 1990s. So you can kind of see how all of these threads started to weave themselves together at the kind of age of the internet. And when these things started to dawn in the early 2000s and how they've come to be today. I mean, Palantir is like this, like we've been talking about. It's like the weird humanitarian vision of it, which I think is worth talking about. This is like a quote from one of the things that Thiel talked about is like this is about reducing terrorism while preserving civil liberties, which is very this is so crazy. But it's kind of a similar vision, I think, to SpaceX. It's kind of similar to what Musk is thinking about with SpaceX, like this idea that we can innovate ourselves into a better world through fascistic means. I mean, that is part of it. That is part of the vision of SpaceX, is go entirely private and colonize the moon. I mean, these are all from the same, they flow from very similar places. Palantir being a company that's claiming that we can solve, I guess, all of the problems of the modern challenges of capitalism by just kind of surveillance, extreme surveillance, and killing people before they become problems, so to speak. So, I mean, I don't know if you're seeing these connections, but I think it's worth talking about Thiel and talking about Musk and kind of how all of these giants, and of course, Alex Karp, as you had kind of went into a deep dive of, but I think tying them all together of understanding how influential they are in the tech industry, but how that tech industry also influences the politics of today. And that's part of the move to the right. I do think there's a lot of people, a lot of young people too, you know, not just to call out Reddit of all the places, but I do think this kind of techno-fascist idea of this vision of the future has been very attractive. I think Musk might have shot himself in the foot a little bit with this, especially with the Tesla protests and kind of people refusing and throwing away the Teslas. But for years, I mean, it was like a sleeper ideology where just your average guy who works in tech, who's, you know, more middle class, but he works in tech and he must have a Tesla. Like that was like a whole political trend, which I think when Musk moved into politics, made him much more of a target for people to kind of see very clearly what was happening. But nonetheless, all of these people have been moving behind the scenes to introduce this fascistic right wing agenda into kind of their capitalist enterprise and into popular culture.
Well, looking at some of the other companies that Thiel himself has invested in, this is always funny to me in a scary way. Just going back to the beginning of our show, one of them is it's a capital company, it's a finance company. It's called Mithril Capital Management. Remember Mithril from let's go back to JRL Token. It's stronger than steel and looks like silver. It's a mineral. Wild how these guys like love Tolkien, but that actually gets right into everything that you're saying. It's like, you know, this whole idea of like the science fiction, the creating a better world, the journey, the, you know, all of those things. In any case, I mean, Thiel's other investments include Facebook, and they include Clearview AI, Bitcoin. He bought like $18 million of Bitcoin like 6 or so years ago. He's invested in SpaceX. He's invested in Stripe. I mean, if you look at the list of companies that he's invested in, many, not entirely all of them, but many of them either fall into the category of financial services or social media in some way. Some of them are like business tools, like things like Asana, but, you know, Quora, Yelp, Spotify, LinkedIn, Friendster. Remember Friendster? You know, like all the social media companies, but also TransferWise, Stripe. There's a bunch of others too that I'm forgetting that, you know, really like the big categories of investments that he has made either directly or through the Founders Fund that he started, interestingly enough, with Sean Parker, the Napster guy. So I think this is actually a good opportunity, Rachel, to look at how Elon Musk is related to all of this. I mean, you mentioned obviously his desire to take humanity, but by that really the only like the top 5% or 0.5% of humanity and his idea, you know, to Mars through SpaceX and his other companies. But meanwhile, back here on Earth, Elon Musk is out of the government and he's pretty pissed off. I don't know if you saw this, but just this afternoon, we're recording on Tuesday, he posted on X, "I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it."
Oh, whoa. Back up. I didn't even see that.
Just a couple hours ago, we're recording this again on Tuesday afternoon. Elon Musk is out of government. He is, you know, the damage that Doge has done and will do is going to continue. Let's be under no confusion there about that. But Elon Musk is gone. I mean, apparently he was getting on Trump's nerves quite a bit, and also all of Trump's staffers. So I think this has been a long time coming. But again, it is not about the man. It is about the mission, so to say. It is about the ideals. So just because Elon Musk isn't in there doing this, but he's clearly very unhappy with this. And now he's speaking out and saying that he thinks that Trump's big, beautiful bill isn't so big or beautiful. I mean, we have to look at the relationship here. Of course, the connection here is that Peter Thiel founded PayPal with, you know, along with Musk. I mean, he was involved early on as well. They have, you know, invested in other companies together. They both have a very significant and positive view of AI. Both of them have invested or started their own AI companies in the case of Musk. And so, you know, looking at these, they do have these differences with both the current administration, with each other. You know, certainly when we're talking about Musk, Karp, and Thiel, they have significant political disagreements with each other. But ultimately, the reality is that they are on the same side, and that is not the side that the rest of us are on. That's actually the big thing to take away here. So whether it's Alex Karp or Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, they approach things differently. They certainly do have different outcomes in some ways that they want, but ultimately they are all about American superiority. They're about Western superiority. They're about racism. They're about hate. They're about war and imperialism, all of them in different ways.
Absolutely. You know, talking about Musk, I do think it's kind of interesting because Thiel and even Alex Karp, which I'm glad you did this deep dive into him because I didn't know as much about him. I've heard his name, but do I know all the details? No. You know, to me, I think it's like they've been able to ride someone in the background a little bit of the kind of sense of they're out there, they're making serious influence and moves within the industry, but like the public at large isn't necessarily paying attention. With Musk, I mean, he really wanted the public at large to pay attention. That was the whole idea of Twitter and X and the whole idea of going into politics in and of itself. But I do think it kind of backfired on him in every way. Like, he moved into politics as an individual, as a person. His companies are tanking. You know, a lot of the in terms of the stocks of his companies are tanking. That might be temporary, so who knows? But regardless, I do think that his credibility, his reputation has taken quite a big hit, just because it's kind of like once you move out of the space of venture capitalism and you move into the space of politics, I think you leave yourself open for the public scrutiny in a way that others are not necessarily paying attention to when you're in just kind of the private sector there. But I do want to say, like, the other part of Elon Musk's scrutiny is that he has absolutely unequivocally destroyed so many parts of the U.S. government that Trump isn't going to reverse. So I kind of want to do a little bit of a retrospective, because now that Trump is now that Musk is no longer in the administration, I don't foresee Trump in any way, shape, or form trying to fix any of the kind of just hacking that like Musk did. He just completely dismantled so many different things like workplace and consumer safety, environmental protections, and like early education, Social Security. I mean, it's very also illegal. So I wonder if Trump's going to throw him under the bus here. And that's part of the reason why he's spitting back about this bill. Maybe he's trying to win back the public's approval after obviously doing some of the most unpopular moves in U.S. history. I mean, this is crazy. The thing that I want to share about and kind of look at in this kind of look back is thinking about what Doge, which also gets me this kind of like these people are very interesting. We have Palantir in this like kind of Tolkien reference. We have Doge, which is like a reference to a meme. And it's like the government is a meme. And like, this is so disturbing because it's like how they play with our lives, how they think it's all a joke or how it's funny or how it's cute or how it's like, I really hate that. It's like that like edgelord attitude. But it's like that went out of 4chan and into like the halls of Congress. Like, that's real. Like, that's very real. But the Doge, which is the Department of Government Efficiency whole project that Musk was putting forward, he claimed it was going to cut $2 trillion in supposed waste or fraud. But his final announcement total in cuts was significantly less. It was about $150 billion. And a lot of people say, you know, people that like are really very in the know, a lot of the news articles I've read said that he didn't even really accomplish that at all. His cuts will cost taxpayers. This was actually from the Partnership for Public Service, the nonprofit organization. They, in an interview with the New York Times, told the New York Times that Elon Musk's cuts could cost taxpayer dollars $135 billion this fiscal year alone, because he fired employees in such a broad brush, chaotic fashion, and the government is likely to have to pay that much money in lawsuits. It's going to be a huge battle ahead. And in at the end of April, even like $436 billion was still being withheld and congressionally approved spending. So that amount includes about $943 million for the Head Start early education programs. Some of the programs have actually closed down or cut back services because they never saw those funds. So a lot of low-income families, people that needed access to these programs, have been scrambling and had to pay for really expensive private childcare. So I think that like that's like in a real-time way how people are experiencing these cuts. I mean, like there's a lot of approved congressional spending. I'm really curious where some of that will go in terms of the limbo, but there's so much more I could recap. I do want to stop there, but I do want to also add that a lot of people are not super aware of. But the kind of one of the major cuts that I keep coming back to and thinking about is the fact that Musk came after and cut National Weather Services. So some parts of the country are getting more abridged weather updates. And in an era of climate change and like the horrors of climate change, how is it like, how are we going to survive if there isn't a like public weather service? I mean, they've really shifted the ideas to kind of loop back to where we started here. You know, Musk's and Trump's agenda here was so much of what the right wing's agenda is, which is to shift the idea around public and private ownership. I think to take away things like the weather service or, of course, some of these other kind of cuts that have been made across the board against the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, which is the one that, like I mentioned, is the National Weather Service. But outside of that, the other elements that are brought into that overall, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, that's really, that's NIOSH. That's the organization that keeps minors safe. It's been decimated, destroyed. It's been protecting. It's been part of the gutting that agency basically has just left so many people, in particular in Arizona, where Trump has been focused on trying to revive coal mines and destroy native land for copper mining. You know, this is all, this office is what kept miners safe and a lot of workers safe, and it's gone. So my point here is that all of these cuts across the board of all these different agencies add up to the right wing agenda of flipping on its face what we know to be public and what we know to be private. And the hope will be by them, I'm certain, to privatize all of this government, all this government's activity. Can we privatize everything and turn it into other versions of military contracts? That's really what I see them wanting to do, is if the National Weather Service becomes a private contract of a private company that only people that pay a subscription fee can get access to, we're in a really, really dangerous times.
That is the libertarian dream, really, that every service that we have publicly now, down to the fire department, emergency services, the weather service, roads even, are just, they're privatized, that the government really does and provides practically nothing except for what the government, what they think the government should do, which is keeping poor people down. That's that libertarian right-wing dream, right? That there should be a military, there should be a police force, and that's about all the government does, except maybe collect a tiny amount of little tax, but really that's not even that was something that, you know, that they want. I think going back to your first point about Elon Musk, you know, Musk was the tool with which Trump chose to cut all these programs. He would have cut them. It's in Project 2025. It's in, you know, it's something that Musk has been, you know, that Trump has been talking about for a long time. Musk was literally just the tool with which they got cut. They would have been cut whether it was Musk or somebody else. And that's the key thing to keep in mind. You know, Musk, he is, well, it's entertaining in some ways. It's depraved in many others. But, you know, yeah, he puts out these big statements, whereas somebody else in government might have just put out a statement, you know, not even, they wouldn't have put out a statement. They would have been frustrated. They would have thought it was a bad bill. Who knows if he even thinks it's a bad bill or not? Like, yeah, I mean, I think he probably does because he was, you know, he wanted to cut so much and it's a significant size bill. But the reality is that, you know, yes, the personal affect of a lot of these people does play a role. Personalities play a role. The relationships do play a role. But at the same time, ultimately, like the goal is the same. So if Trump and Musk are on the outs, really, I don't think that changes a whole lot. It might change something for SpaceX's contracts, but maybe Blue Origin picks those up. It might change, you know, change something for XAI, but OpenAI picks up those contracts. Who knows, you know, what the details are going to be. But I think in the big picture, Rachel, it's really not a significant significant move in the way history moves. It's interesting for us to talk about today, interesting for us to look at. But, you know, Musk being on the in or on the out, I think not going to change the path of history on the broader scale. But I think we are going to have to leave it right there. And if you like what you heard today and you want to support independent journalism, go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine and become a patron. We can only do this show with the support of our listeners. So if you want to hear more, go to the Patreon to support. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin with Chris Garaffa.
And Rachel Hu. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you miss any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you can find podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. We're all out of time for today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.
Covert Action.